Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
March 17, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? You found it. And you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it's Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week for O'Chelly.com and the O'Chelly Effect. Welcome to you, no matter where you are, when you are, whatever, because most of you will catch this further on down the stream and all that via the podcast facilities. Anyway, who do I have? Well, I'm blessed with the Thursday rotation here because I've got Michael Swanson on with me in the first hour, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, of course, the author of The War State. Now we have a recycled War State commercial that you'll hear during all the shows on O'Chelly.com, but also the author of Why the Vietnam War. And I endorse both of these books. Why the Vietnam War is the first in a series of books that Mike is writing related to, the Vietnam War. The War State is a book I recommend, though, especially if you are an avid follower of historical writing and you want to understand things that went on in a certain time period there. Say, post-World War II America and how the military-industrial complex has played things out, and there's a nice section in there on the Cuban Missile Crisis and on and on. And Mike's writing style is really great because he takes very complex things and makes them understandable. But you can also be in the know at WallStreetWindow.com because it's not just about Wall Street. It's about everything. Anyhow, in the second hour, we have the author Larry Hancock with us. And no, he's not going to discuss Ukraine. Although there's no rule against it. We're going to change directions a little. Although Mike Swanson might have a few things to say about Ukraine because I don't script this out and he can say what he wants. And it's always great to talk to him. Michael, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing okay. Let me ask you this about the Ukraine news. You know, this has been going on now, you said, 3 weeks.
They're about, yeah.
Yeah. Do you believe, I mean, the gas prices have gone up. This news event is nonstop coverage. I was out of town when the invasion started, right, and I didn't see any television news. I mentioned to you in one of the previous shows, I was speaking with someone on the phone, and they were really caught up in the event. I had the feeling they were enjoying it in a certain sense, but I kind of felt like they were telling me propaganda stories, and the stories that they were excited about turn out not to be true. For example, something about a Snake Island, I think it's called, where these people supposedly said they weren't going to surrender and were killed, and then they weren't. It turns out they weren't killed, and then some story about these Russians are coming in, and some old lady said they're going to need sunflower seeds or they're going to become plants or something, and that turned out that to be true. But on one hand, I haven't watched the television news but three times and then turn it off, right. Because I was reading the New York Times and different news sources. I subscribed to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, then spend about an hour every morning looking through various headlines and so forth. Nowhere as intensive as the thing that you can get from newsvandal.com, but I do look at different sources. And I was trying to look at foreign media, especially in Germany, because I was really – I trade the financial markets and honestly, wanted to see – try to figure out how they would react, how big the sanctions would be. And even I'm not doing it. I'm not advocating it. You couldn't do it if you wanted to, but even considering before the war, I'll put it this way. I owned stocks in Russia, a couple, and I sold them, before the war began.
Well, probably a smart thing because, a lot of Russian businesses are being disallowed from doing business at the moment. via the sanctions. But to speak to this other media thing that you were talking about to begin with, I observed the whole Snake Island thing, and at first was rather moved. But again, there's a massive amount of virtue signaling that is effectively occurring here in Western media in general, where they have gone to and look, I'd love to be on their side, but I know it's disingenuous, where they're trying to show the horror of war. They don't usually care about this, Mike. They don't
Read before we got on the show that, that it, again, I didn't watch this. I'm just reading a story about it. Yeah. But on CNN, on the 8 o'clock TV show, that's got Erin Burnett as the anchor.
Right.
She did a segment interviewing a Ukrainian man whose wife and children had been killed by the Russians. Right. And they had pictures of them. And the anchor, she cried on the air.
Yeah, yeah. Again, though,
you know, that's a pretty. I don't know if I've ever seen anything like that.
Well, see,
on television,
we have not, and that's the thing. Look, I'm not saying I'm inside of anybody's head, but I take it as disingenuous because these very same people have flippantly described the destruction of other human beings. Okay, in other conflicts. And have never shown any sort of anything about it. I mean, it's just pretty much like reading off a grocery list. Erin Burnett, too. And she's not the only one who ran that segment, Mike. They started running that segment like 2 days ago. They have these pre-recorded pieces that they keep pushing into their different shows, okay? And one of them has been about that. The other one now is about this bomb shelter, which apparently had children written all around it. And the Russians bombed it anyway. There's all those things going on. The Snake Island thing, as you said, we went back and forth on this because at first they showed the recording, the Defiant recording, and they said, okay, all these guys are dead. And the Russians rightfully claimed, no, we captured them. They surrendered after a bit. They did resist, but then they surrendered. And the Western media effectively said, well, we don't know if we can trust the Russians. And it turns out the Russians were able to produce them, I guess, at a certain point and say, look, they're still alive. There is the segment which is commonly being used now about war crimes. And it's not just that network, by the way. A bunch of them are doing this. Now,
all this said, I have no doubt, you know, that the Russians are getting, you know, fed propaganda and even that's...
Sure.
Less true. In fact, this afternoon, I went to the RT.com website, and there's an article on there about, you know, something Putin said about the war and explaining the reasons for it. And I think that was not true, the things he was saying. Right. And then I sent you a clip I saw, just a little thing on Twitter that he did yesterday, I think it was, on their television, basically saying that if you're not for the war, you're a traitor. I mean, it's very, the language, he's saying you're scum, saying all these things. I mean, it's suggesting that you're going to go to jail or they're going to set up gulags or something.
Well, I didn't even
you
go
know,
there.
If you're not on board with,
I didn't
with
even
this whole situation.
Right there. I didn't even go there yet because the other thing that they're inserting into the newscasts is this whole thing about this woman that disrupted a Russian TV broadcast.
Yeah.
And she could be facing 15 years in prison because that's apparently one of the penalties. And look, all I'm trying to say is that on both sides of this right now, there is a lot of disingenuous reporting. The horrors of war are real all the time. You know, the idea that, oh, innocent people are being targeted. I'm sorry to say, that happens everywhere. Everywhere, and I don't care whose side you're on, this is what happens, okay?
And I'm not, you know, the point I'm trying to make, not to suggest both sides are equal, but I wonder... Well, I suspect that we are seeing a war in a different way than we ever have before. I mean, the first Iraq war was all, you know, was on television. It was a CNN special, but it was completely sanitized. We were the ones at that point. I mean, you could, you know, attacking another country after they attacked a country, but we were doing the incursion
right.
into Iraq. The second Iraq war, the same story.
Right.
The Afghanistan war, even less footage. But all the footage that we got out of those wars, it's not simply that they were, you know, they learned the lesson for Vietnam to really be careful of, and control what the reporters are even seeing. But this situation now is different,
right.
I think, because this is the first war in which we're getting information, not really primarily from the TV channels, but from social media, which the TV channels are then picking up.
Well, right. There's also the instance of a Ukrainian woman who is, you know, pretty much live tweeting 24 hours a day, everything that's happening in her city, which I think is Odessa. And all of the media is now beginning to follow that Twitter account, which I find strange. It's like, you know, here's our news source, a Twitter account. Okay. All I'm saying is that at the end of all of this, Mike, you got to understand that this is now very profitable to side with the suffering Ukrainians. And I do believe that that is their actual motive here, that people are tuning in more. The ratings are going up, okay, because people are tuning in to watch the horror show. It says something about our voyeuristic nature as a country, as a society, for sure.
Now, I'm going to tell you something interesting.
Yeah.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but
no, go ahead. Go ahead. It's all right.
Well, and then you said there's a couple. There's one story I want to really focus on before the soon.
Sure.
But the one problem. Well, the guy caught one feeling. Let me ask you this before I get into some of this other stuff. I'm wondering if people are getting stressed out from all this stuff. The gas prices are going up, and this constant war thing is causing people to feel stress. It is for me, or I realized it was, and I was like, I gotta get back away from this a little bit.
Yeah, the longer arc is that, look, we went through a time of stress, which was called the Trump administration, okay? When it comes to people that were following the news and trying to pay attention to stuff, that sort of calmed down. The next big stressor was clearly the COVID reality. And I'm not even making a statement about how I feel about it here. I'm just saying the constant barrage of disease, death, fear, new variants. Are you going to get the shot? Are you not going to get it? Are you wearing your mask?
I went back and looked at the COVID thing. Mm-hmm. And me personally, what has happened is in March of 2020 mm-hmm. and over the past 3 weeks, I have had to I'd spent a lot of time trading the financial markets, but most of the time I'm not doing anything. And then there's moments where the markets move and, you know, they're at a tipping point, or they could be, and I have to almost watch it hourly.
Right.
And I'm making a lot more frequent trades. And in March of 2020,
right.
You know, I got out of the stock market completely when it was 10% off its high, about a third through the crash. And they announced I could see the virus cases multiplying in the United States.
Right.
And after I got out, it was, I think, a week later that Trump was on television and announcing the travel ban. And he did that a day. I think it was the NBA canceled their games, suspended their season.
Right.
So I got out a week before it just really hit everyone's consciousness. But I saw it. But that experience in the market was melting down. The bond market was locking up. Right. It was just as bad. What was going on inside the market was just as bad as what happened in 2008. People don't really know that, but it was, in some ways it was worse.
Right.
And so I, was intensely into, following all this stuff nonstop. And I was having nightmares, before the lockdowns began, knowing, you know, the world is changing in some way or another, and all this, you know, bad things are going to happen. Right. You know, I was dreaming about it, which is, I don't normally have nightmares, but and then I look back and that George Floyd, we were doing shows regularly,
right?
You know, every single week, but I took a break for 1 or 2 weeks, and I got food poisoning, and got sick for 2 or 3 days, mm-hmm. and when I woke up, I had taken a break that I consciously tried to get away from all the news, thinking I was mentally exhausted from all this.
Right.
And had to take a break. And I wasn't on your show. And then I woke up after like a week of being disengaged. Seems like a week. Maybe it was 5 days. But regardless,
sure.
I was really disengaged from the world. I was laying in bed for 48 hours. And then when I woke up, I found out that all these riots were going on, or demonstrations over George Floyd, and they had been going on for like a week. So I was like Rip Van Winkle, you know, well, waking up.
And yes and no, because here's what happened. Okay, in the you know, post action analysis, we find out that, you know, everybody was screaming about, oh, the whole country's like, you know, having riots. Wasn't true. It just was not true. The majority of those protests ended up being peaceful.
Oh, no, I agree.
No, but here's the thing. The news media's role in all of this, right, whether it is, you know, the Trump presidency, or it is the coronavirus, you know, fear-mongering, or it is this thing where whole country's on fire, you know, they've continuously tried to do something to engage the audience. You need excitement. You need something. It bleeds, it leads. Let's go.
Oh, yeah.
And they did this all the way through. And again, the virtue signaling there, totally disingenuous and abandoned as soon as, you know, basically interest starts to peter out.
Biden in his State of the Union said he wants to fund the police.
Yeah, well, sure.
It's a complete repudiation of...
A complete
demonstrators.
Repudiation of the alleged, you know, left position, right? Which is not even the majority of the left position. See, that's the thing. They keep leveraging a small thing into a much larger issue. And now, in this circumstance that we're in, yeah, that created a spirit of the time that was stressful. So you had stressors that went from the Trump presidency to COVID to, you know, race riots in America, okay? And then for a little while, if you notice, we went back to all COVID all the time. And I even started calling CNN the Coronavirus News Network, because that's what made the most sense. They were 24 hours a day. New cases. Fauci again. You know, here's another person. The CDC. Let's get the new latest. Okay, we got to go right to the president. It's a briefing on the virus, on what's happening, what's happening. Let's go to the hospitals. They're all heroes. Don't forget. They were doing that as much as they could, and their ratings were failing, okay? Then Putin invades Ukraine. All of a sudden, your top headlines, your absolute need to track all the virus and everything, gone. Now it's all this, 24 hours a day, and it's working for them. They haven't had a good ratings bonanza, really, across the board in the corporate media since Trump left office, okay? So now they've gone back to this because it's working. It is the sympathy that they're drawing upon from their viewers, which is legitimate, but they're doing it from a distance, right? And it just, it kills me. It's like, I can't believe the disingenuous nature of this. I'd love to agree with it. And, you know, but now there's a new judgment, right? Not just whether you're wearing a mask or not. It tells you what kind of human being you are. But are you with Ukraine or not? You know, and the truth is, are we as a nation with Ukraine? Well, we sent them $1 billion. Uh-huh. Well, did that $1 billion put a stop to this? Is there something? Are we legitimately just watching this collapse and we're just going to watch? You know, it's not like the U.S. has never intervened in a place where they had no business intervening. But, of course, you know, what is the threat? Well, it could bring on. What did Biden say? That's called World War III. Malarkey. You know, I mean, for real. This is where we're at, right? And all of this is a stressor in a time when we're dealing with the financial reality. I mean, Mike, I tell you, brutal personal truth here. I started to do a little better financially, and simultaneously what went along with that is I started getting crushed by legitimate inflation. Not at 7%. That is not the inflation reality to me. Okay, I'm getting hit way harder. And I grant you, I'm not in the expensive place to live, but I assure you, the percentage of inflation is not anywhere near 7%. It's more like 30. Okay, well, so all of a sudden...
The Federal Reserve yesterday, they raised interest rates from 0 to 0.25%. And they said in their statement, and the chairman gave a press conference, you know, repeating this stuff. They, you know, officially they're saying inflation is 7.9%.
Garbage, but yeah.
But in that statement, they said they're going to raise interest rates. Here's the thing. Historically, in order to stop inflation, they have to raise interest rates higher than the rate of inflation.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then inflation goes down. Well, if they raised interest rates to 8% really quickly, the stock market would completely crash.
Of course.
And, you know, and they don't want to do that. So, and it would scare, you know, it'd scare people in the stock market. So what they said is they're going to raise interest rates really slow and get them, this is what they're predicting, get them to 2.5% by next year, and then inflation's going to go away, because they claim that the real inflation rate is now, you said 30%. Well, they're saying it's actually probably 3%, and that everything above that 3% is temporary because of the Ukraine war and supply chain problems.
Yeah, see,
all it's temporary, it will go away and be fixed, and they could just get to 2.5% and everything will be okay in 2 years.
Yeah. I'm not mad.
That's what they're saying.
Yeah. I'm not mad at you, Mike, but I want you to know that this pisses me off. This is absolute garbage.
Yeah, well, they're just trying to help out the stock market.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what? Helping out the stock market is not all of us, okay? I'm sorry. Man.
No, it's crazy.
It's insane. This is what they do. It's 1/10 of a response every time, right? So even with this, the pressure of the inflation was happening before Putin made the move. So I don't want to hear about that. Really, that is the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard. And these idiots on CNN, by the way, I was watching and somebody tweeted something out about, you know, look at how the oil companies are making money. And I'm looking right at something on CNN. This was yesterday. They were trying to do the explanation that I've given you about the fuel and about how this is nonsense that they're jacking it up the way they are and they're making these record high profits, okay? They were sitting there trying to explain it and saying, you know, listen, even though the fuel price went from, the oil price, excuse me, went from $120-something dollars down to $90-something dollars, right? I forget the exact numbers because it was just really ridiculous. Even though that happened, you got to understand that some of the gasoline at the pump, the reason why it's still going up by another 13% during this time period, even though we see a reduction about a quarter in the price, right? You take away 30 from 120, you get about a quarter. So you got a 25% reduction in the oil price and a 13% increase during the same time period on the gasoline price. They're saying, well, you got to understand that they might have bought oil during the time when it was at 120. And I'm going, yeah, okay. That didn't happen until after Putin invaded. That's less than 3 weeks ago. So therefore, you're lying. You know nothing about what you're talking about because you don't get oil to the gas pump in 3 weeks. Okay? I'm not trying to yell at you, Mike. I'm sorry. It's just, I'm looking at it going, I can't believe these people are lying directly. Like, here, I'm here to explain. I'm your fuel. I forget what they called the guy, but he was like, you know, our fuel correspondent. You know, they always have a correspondent for something like that. That one guy, Richard, whatever, who was very intense and very much spoke like this with his eyes squinted when that airplane disappeared and he was all of a sudden an aviation correspondent. Remember that guy? So they always pull out a specialized correspondent. And this correspondent for Fuel knows nothing of what he's talking about. Okay, and he's trying to explain that Russian oil does affect the price. And he told some of the truth, but it was like a complete misrepresentation of how this works. I mean, Mike, if I told you, well, the reason why your gas price is still going up right now is because, you know, we're dealing with that $120 price from 2 weeks ago, you'd think I was insane. That is not a practical metric to say that's applied to the price right now. It doesn't work that way. Now, do they raise the prices at the pump ahead of when the actual product goes up? Yes, they do. Thusly, why do they have record high profits still, Mike? Because of that. This is what they do. Do you think really the cost of your fuel, the cost of oil, actually always spikes at Christmas time? You think that always happens, or it always spikes in the summer when people are about ready to travel? No. The fuel companies, they take advantage of that time period when they know people are going to travel for sure. And why do I bring this up? Because it is the key as to what they lost when the lockdowns happened. A lot of people stopped traveling, Mike. You know very well. They stopped using fuel. It wasn't as necessary. People didn't go anywhere. You're not going to consume gasoline. It's that simple. So what happened? We saw the metric in the oil break. I've never heard of that before. Now you might be able to study the past and find some other case where they had a negative oil price.
No, it never happened before.
I didn't think it did, but logically, it should never happen. Point is that metric is broken. The idea that there is a direct correlation between the delivery of that oil and the price at the gas pump is an absolute fallacy. Okay, because if you were to track it properly, as I've said on this show many times, and by the way, I've reconfirmed this, even though I used to work in that business and haven't in some years, I've reconfirmed this with people still working in that business. They can, if an emergency occurs, get it down to about a 60-day turnaround. From the purchase of that oil directly at a price point, like today, 60 days from now, it'll get to the pump, if there's an emergency. Normal procedure gets it there in about 90 days. Now, it's not perfect. It slides a little, a couple weeks, one way or the other. But this is an accurate metric. Still, to this day, 90-day turnaround from the purchase of oil to gasoline presented at the pump in America. Okay? They're not telling you that. They're trying to tell you, well, it's all about the Ukraine conflict. It's garbage. They're trying to tell you all about this pressure. And like I said, I'm saying 30%. Because again, there are some things that didn't move. You and I talked about this. There are some things that didn't move on the inflationary curve. Maybe they're at 2%. And they're holding back the real inflationary curve on things that you buy. Now, if you don't buy socks and socks didn't change in price, then it doesn't have an effect on your inflationary purchases, does it? Okay, I'm just throwing out one thing there, a possibility. Just to give you an idea, it all depends on what you're purchasing. I know factually, based on what I'm buying, what they're charging me for the things that I am subscribed to, like energy into my home, gasoline, and food, and things like this. I know I'm looking at 30%. There is a 30% difference now from the beginning of the year, Mike. 30%. That's how much more I have to pay to get the same result I got at the beginning of this very year. I promise you that's accurate. And I also promise you that in many other places, it may be higher. Okay, some of the higher living places like New York or whatever, the real inflationary point is probably more like 19% because it was already high cost of living there. But the squeeze is on everywhere. Now, as far as the stock market goes, I got no idea what to tell you there. It makes no sense to me that the stock market hasn't already crashed, Mike. Okay? Like, it should have crashed 2-3 times in the past 5 years. And it really didn't. There was a hell of a dip, but it didn't really crash, did it?
the S&P's fallen 14% year to date.
Okay, 14%.
So, and now it's getting ready to bounce a little bit.
Yeah, but 14%, that would not be something that you would immediately go, it crashed, right?
No, I mean, I think it's a bear market and going to fall later, but 14% isn't enough to get people that own stocks to care.
Uh-huh. No.
You know, no one's telling you, no one you know is telling you, oh, I'm losing money or it's crashing on me. They're not saying that. They're all think it's just a little dip.
Well, you and I have covered this before. Generally speaking, when people are losing money, they don't say they're losing money, right? I mean, who goes out there and says, hey, I'm losing money? they usually don't, not publicly. Does it happen? Sure it does. But
the stock market's not, you know, that important. Right now, I feel, to me, the moment is a little similar. It's not the same. Frankly, in 2020, when I was telling you I was having nightmares, what I was scared of, and I went back and looked, that George Floyd, his death happened almost 8 weeks after the shutdowns happened. So it was a 2-month period.
Yeah.
So it took about 2 months for me to have to take a break from the whole thing, but for at least several days. But anyway, what I was scared of then was that there would be such severe disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
The article that scared me the most was before the lockdown started, there's an article that said that the military was keeping their soldiers on base, not allowing them to leave their bases.
Right.
They weren't even transporting troops from one base to another. So the military was locked down. And some general gave some interviews saying, one of the reasons we're doing this is in case there's, you know, a civil disorder, we need to keep the troops healthy, but also in case they're needed to maintain order. Well, I was scared that there would be such severe, perhaps, problems that maybe it'd be hard to get food at the grocery store. You know, people did panic initially, you know, went crazy buying toilet paper and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I was more worried about months later that, you know, it'd be so bad there'd be food riots.
Right.
But none of that happened. It was clear it wasn't going to be that bad. And the so-called riots, as you're explaining, weren't that, you know, weren't really that much of a riot.
No.
Compared to past history. So what did happen was nothing like what I was worried about. But the moment now, these past 3 weeks, I believe there are things going on that is going to change the world and even our daily lives.
Yes.
That we don't really even know about.
See, exactly.
Suggest one of them are in a minute. I'm going to tell you what I really think is going on. Well,
great. Great. I'm looking forward to it because, Mike, I got to tell you, I'm getting tired of the excuse game. Okay, I do care about the fact that people are suffering in Ukraine, right? I'm not virtue signaling.
One of the things that's happened, I can't tell you why. So, as I said, I read the three major U.S. newspapers. They're establishment newspapers. The Wall Street Journal is sort of a mouthpiece for business people.
Right.
It's written for business people.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times, the Washington Post, they are mouthpieces for the national security state, particularly the New York Times.
CIA with the New York Times, but go ahead. I said particularly the CIA for the New York Times, but please continue.
And I forward you in JP, a couple other people, a couple articles written over the past 6 months by one of the reporters, and he writes these articles as if he is speaking for the Pentagon and the Biden administration, and they're directed at China and Russia.
Yeah,
you know, he writes it as if these are, as if you would be an American reading Pravda, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the report, one feeling I've got from this is, I feel in this war that I don't really want to watch the TV. I don't really want to read these things.
Right.
Not simply because I don't want to get emotionally caught up in it, but I think they don't really know what's going on. And there's a fog of war that's just going to happen. And the reason I don't think they know what's going on is because I was reading these publications in the lead up of this.
Mm-hmm.
And they openly said in articles, the U.S. intelligence community does not know what Putin's going to do. They don't have anyone, a double agent or whatever. They don't have intelligence about what Putin's thinking or his inner circle.
So what they did, Mike, is threw everything up against the wall and said, this is possible, this is possible. They might cause false flags. They might turn around and do this. They threw everything out there up against the wall. And I don't know if you remember, but at the time I commented to you, it's very strange to have them making these statements where this is possible, this is possible, this is possible, as if they're setting it up for almost anything to happen because they don't know. And that's the reality of the situation.
I'm going to tell you something real troubling.
Yes.
With the New York Times. So who's the source of these stories? Well, they've quoted a couple times experts at a certain think tank that in one story they said this was the main source for, this is after the war started, for the maps they're creating and figuring out the disposition of the forces and so forth, or what's going on in the war. And they cited a think tank called the Institute for the Study of War.
Yeah.
Well, and they got a website, understandingwar.com.
Right.
And you can go there and you can see who is this. Well, and it says our history, our mission, and so forth.
Right.
Well, it was founded by Kimberly Kagan and General Jack Keane in 2007 to lobby for the surge in Iraq. And it says, that doesn't use the word lobby, but I'll quote what they say. Their words, they wanted to provide real-time, independent, open-source analysis of ongoing military operations and insurgent attacks in Iraq in order to document developments on the ground and the detrimental effect of biased reporting on policymakers. And then who's on their board? Well, Kimberly Kagan is the daughter, I think, of Robert Kagan. Could be the wife, either way.
I think you're right, but could be wife.
But,
go ahead.
But anyway, you also got Kelly Kraft. Who's Kelly Kraft? Uh-huh. Well, she was Trump's ambassador to the United Nations in Canada. Her husband is Joseph Kraft. Mm-hmm. He's a billionaire who's a coal baron in Kentucky. And he was one of the biggest donors of the 2016 Trump campaign. You got William Kristol on here. You got Joseph Lieberman and General Petraeus himself.
That's right.
So I'm just saying this is where a lot of the information is coming from. Now, here's one of the stories that they have. So one of the key events for me. And I think impacting all of us is the sanctions.
Right.
The size of the sanctions. Now, they're saying right now, disagree with it or not, and I think you're right. I think it's just a portion of the reason we got this inflation we got now. But they're blaming the inflation on the sanctions we have against Russia and not borrowing the oil from them. Well, when the war started, I was reading different stories and I was trying to see what the sanctions were going to be, because to have some impact on the financial markets and the economy. Well, at first, there's a story in the New York Times saying that they weren't going to do the Swift Bank, the ban on the Swift Bank transactions. And it said that the Treasury Department was against it. Mm-hmm. And so was staffers in there from Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. And Germany, I was reading German sources, they're against it. And one argument that the Treasury Department had was that if they use the dollar as a weapon to this extent and ban Russia from SWIFT and, mm-hmm. and ban them, Russia has accumulated all these dollar reserves to prepare for the moment they're in now. And they've been banned. Their central bank has been banned from transacting in dollars. They can't sell dollars to support the ruble. This is a form of economic warfare beyond
yes.
what happened in the Cold War, beyond even what the Roosevelt did against Japan. We banned oil sales to Japan. We didn't ban their central bank and currency right. transactions
right.
With the entire Western world. So this was a serious decision that was made.
Yes.
Now, the Treasury Department, Janet Yellen and these Morgan people and Goldman Sachs people, they said they didn't want to do it
right.
before they happened, because at least this is what was reported in the New York Times, because if they did it, this could actually cause other central banks around the entire world to say, uh-oh, our dollar reserves, our treasury bonds that we've accumulated,
dump them,
could be turned on us or nullified. They could do the same thing to us.
Dump them and so, devalue them, because, yeah, that would be a way. Look.
Well, yeah. What, it wasn't so much that they would crash them, but that they would just say, okay, we better not keep buying these dollars. And this, over time, not immediately, but over time, would threaten the reserve status of the U.S. dollar, which if that, you know, that's enabling us to live at a higher standard of living than people do in other countries, enables the government to easily finance its deficit. So they're saying, don't do this.
Right.
Because of that.
Have you ever watched the Zeitgeist movies, Mike?
Oh, yeah. I've seen
Okay, it. So in the second Zeitgeist movie, about 10, 15 minutes in,
yeah,
after they explain the Federal Reserve, okay, which I think is a fairly adequate and accurate description of the way it used to work, I urge you to go ahead and rewatch that section. Anybody who's listening, go ahead and rewatch the section about 10, 15 minutes in. To show you why this exact thing that you're saying is precise and accurate. They lay it out so that you understand that globalization causes exactly these problems. And the fact is that this is a form of economic warfare that has been practiced over and over again, never against an enemy who was actually directly involved in military conflict, like. And that's the thing. It's not attached to the Ukrainian situation. It's not stopping what's happening on the ground there, is it? It's not going to, but it is going to have a consequence, and the consequence is, with everything so disconnected, okay, without these trade barriers in place that used to be there to begin with, see, that's why it's not even fair to mention Japan and the oil embargo, because we didn't have the same state of globalization with the monetary funds like we do today. It's a totally different world now. Everything is interconnected.
I don't even think they sanctioned the Nazi Germany
until afterwards. See, that's the thing. Yeah, These kind of punishments go to the vanquished enemies. This is usually the kind. I mean, that's what they did post World War One, right? I mean, they punished we know about the Weimar. We know what happened. Okay. The reconstruction that occurred there and all that other stuff was a bonanza for these people that siphoned everything out of these nations that were defeated. Very simple.
So
this is being done as if Russia's already defeated, and it's not. This is worse than the Cold War, you know, again, financial warfare that took place during the Cold War. That's all true. And now what they're trying to do, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, is bring in China into this.
Well, so one thing that's happened in the last week is this week, Saudi Arabia said, okay, we're going to get away from these dollars, and we're going to start to sell some of our oil, the oil we sell to China, we're going to get wands from it. So they're in the Saudis and OPEC famously made a deal in the 1970s to only price oil in dollars. So now they're reneging on that.
Right.
Just as the Treasury Secretary warned, you know, people, other countries might start reacting, and they are starting to react. Now, so why did they do it? So, and who did it? Who's behind it? So
there's a big question.
This is
mind,
the story in the New York Times. It's the only place I've seen it reported.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Jacob Sullivan? He is the national security advisor for Biden, and he had some staff guy of his that they crafted the sanctions. And lobbied for him. And the story is that the New York Times tells. Obviously, I'm going to tell you why I don't believe it. But the story they tell is that the European Union, the staff member of the president, was also for the sanctions. I believe that. And actually, interestingly enough, Boris Johnson came out advocating these sanctions before they were announced. So he was the first world leader to demand them, which is interesting. So the story told is that Zelensky got on a Zoom call with the European Union,
right,
and asked for the sanctions. And was, you know, whipped the people. I mean, this is what it says. They describe the people on the Zoom call, world leaders, European Union, the head of the head people in the European Union, watching Zelensky on a call, and a day or two after the war started, and they got so, and he was crying,
right.
And some of them cried. And after the meeting, they agreed to the sanctions. And so the United States. So,
okay.
According to the New York Times, this world leader, this Zelensky got on a Zoom call, cried, and all these other people cried, and they decided to ditch the way the monetary system's been operating since Nixon got off the gold standard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they made an emotional decision.
Yeah.
To do that. Now I read that.
Yeah.
And I tell you this, saying I don't believe it.
Good.
I believe this decision was too big to make based on pure emotion.
You're right.
And they are selling that story as propaganda.
They are selling a decision that was already made. Okay.
Is a consequential decision that's going to impact the rest of our lives. I'm not saying the dollar's crashing or the economy's melting down or anything like that, but it's going to impact our lives. It's a sign that geopolitically, you know, if you don't have one, you know, it's going to take several years for this all to play out, but geopolitically, the world's going to collapse.
Right.
Probably into a couple blocks, maybe continental blocks or something, and the financial system's going to decentralize too. It may be a good thing, you know, but it's going to cause inflation and the cost of living for goods in the United States to go up. You're not going to be able to get,
right,
you know, these cheap phones or whatever. They're not really cheap. They're marked up to the moon from Apple.
Right.
And this junk.
Well, but here's the overall issue, Mike. And in all the things that we've discussed today, I got to tell you, one theme emerges. And it is as follows. They are retroactively explaining something that was already happening with alleged news. Okay? That's what's going on. Whether it's, we're suffering from inflation because of Ukraine. No, you're not. It was already happening. See, this has become the standard. Let's explain what's happening by later on having an event occur that now justifies what's going on. The sanctions were going to come one way or another. If it wasn't this, they would have claimed that somebody else was poisoned or because they had that basketball player in custody, whatever. They would have made more sanctions, okay? They couldn't go to the extreme until they had some sympathy from the public to support it. You got to do something. All right? And this is the reality. And like I said on this show last week, I feel as though the American public is being held hostage, is being told effectively, look, you don't want to go into another war? Well, this is the way we're going to have to conduct the war. Financially. Now,
I don't know the, you know, I just know what I've told you. I don't know. I'm going to try to find. I don't have the information now. I've heard someone suggest something. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the full reasons that this decision's been made. The person that made this, Jacob Sullivan guy, seems to be the guy that drove it. Who is he? You know, he is a Rhodes Scholar.
Mm-hmm.
He appears to have been a Clinton protege,
uh-huh.
Hillary Clinton. He was her like chief of staff,
yep,
and an advisor to Obama, mm-hmm. and an advisor to Biden over the years too. So, but I think the key is he's a Rhodes Scholar and started with Clinton. I think that's, you know, where he got started. So it's kind of, you know, the Rhodes Scholar thing is a whole interesting connection. Because those people tend to, they go to England, they go to Oxford, they tend to go into the diplomatic corps, a lot of them.
And they have privileged paths throughout their lives once they get the blessing from the organization that bears Cecil Rhodes' name.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things, isn't it? No surprise there. But again, this is the retroactive justification for everything. Let's look back. Well, you know, it was because of the coronavirus that we were getting squeezed. You don't like that explanation? Well, how about the Ukraine conflict? You don't like that explanation? Well, how about the sanctions that we had to put out there? You don't like that explanation? I don't know what they're coming up with next, but here's what I do know. Neocons and neoliberals have a desire to shape the world, and they're not really going to care exactly who they got to chisel out of it to make their shape, okay? And this is what we're witnessing. I can't see it any other way, Mike. And yeah, it's going to hurt. It's hurting now. You know, I found it remarkable. You brought up the State of the Union. And I'll let you take the last 5 minutes or so with this. Because I was stunned by the idiocy that came out of Biden's mouth during the State of the Union. It was like he was president of the United States in an alternate universe. Everything's doing well. We're doing so good. All we have to... Are you out of your mind? Are you... Where do you live? Where do you live? I keep asking. Is anybody you know... And Mike, I'm not trying to put this on you, but in all seriousness, think about this, anybody listening. Is anybody you know doing any better in the past couple of years than they were? Because we've been on a downward slope for sure. But now we're getting accelerated down the slope because your cost of housing has jumped up. Your cost of just the things that you need to survive have jumped up. It's not at no 8% or 7.9, whatever it is they're calling it. This is a grand manipulation and, quite frankly, a systematic siphoning of anything resembling wealth out of the entire Western world. We're getting it here. We're not protected anymore. If the petrodollar goes, you're going to see it a lot more. We're going to see all kinds of a lack of equilibrium in the the financial realities that are supposed to be rock solid. You know, here's supply and demand, and here's the way capitalism is supposed to work. All that is about to go out the window, Mike.
Well, let me. I'll give you a reason.
Go ahead.
I mean, supposedly, and I gotta find some. I've heard someone say that in the financial world say this. I gotta find it for myself. Mm-hmm. But supposedly, there have been studies done or think tank papers that have said that the United States that the Treasury bonds that China owns, and you suggested this. You said they could just sell them. Yeah. They could just sell the bonds and crash everything. There have been papers written that say that's a national security threat, that the risk of them doing that is real, and that the United States eventually, is people have always been saying this most of our lives, but is going to become so indebted that all this is going to just blow up anyway. And China's at threat of dumping these bonds. So the idea is that by sanctioning Russia's central bank and preventing them from selling bonds or the dollar, we've therefore now created a switch where we can prevent China from doing it too. So that potential risk of them just selling everything is gone. You see what I mean?
Yeah, but see, I find that laughable, and I'll tell you why just in 10 seconds. There is no way that they're just going to get stuck with that. If they're going to get stuck with the useless monetary instrument, look, you and I both know there must be a way to convert it one way or another. Somebody will take it, even at a cut rate, and it'll get done. Right? I mean, it's just that simple. It can get done. It just doesn't have to get done in the standard way. And somebody always innovates a way to get around this stuff one way or another. Okay? Mike, I got to tell you, I've read about the national security threat also, but, you got to be realistic about this. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will prevail at all times here. And I don't know, man. I give you the last couple of minutes and close this out any way you want because we're at the end of the hour, but... definitely does not look good for the very near future, my friend.
Well, I mean, what's going on over there is a tragedy. There's no doubt about that, and I hope it's the quicker it's resolved, the better for everyone, especially the people living there. But I'm just trying to say that I can't predict everything that's going on. I don't know everything that's going on, and the people on television and much of the media, they just make these assertions, I feel, in a lot of cases that they really have no basis for making. But it's just it's an unpredictable situation. But what's clear is that just like when that March of COVID thing came, or 9/11, the world is changing. Well, it is now, perhaps in a bigger way than those previous two times.
You know what? The world is about to change. That is the only thing I am absolutely certain of. But as you said, even if we take a look at the bit of pain that might be involved with turning things into a less centralized situation with the monetary funds, etc., perhaps that's a blessing in disguise, but it's going to hurt getting there, Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all there is to it. And if you're not hurting already, I don't know what country you live in. Because, again, we're all getting squeezed. Now, as for who and why, well, you can figure it out. But those financial people, they don't want to tell you anything's going wrong. Nobody wants to tune in and hear, holy crap, the world is on fire. Nobody wants to hear the dollar is dying because too many people have too many of them. So, anyway, Michael Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. I don't know if he's going to get into this kind of darkness over there, but I do know he reports on not just the market, but global events as well. The author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War. But appreciate you, Mike, and I hope we can do this again next week.
Thank you. I'll be here next week. Talk to you later.
Excellent. In the next hour, Larry Hancock, and we'll be talking Unidentified on the Ocelli Effect. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Nibiru, also known as Planet X, was going to get within the gravitational pull of the Earth and cause mass commotion and chaos?
More that. More commotion. More confusion. It goes into the confusion thing. Hey, going nut, he's going back, and it's going crazy.
I hate being confused like that.
But that's exactly how he works it.
It is, but at the Ocelli.com radio network, you're never confused.
No, it's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
It's about time. Forget this Nibiru stuff and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
.com, and he'd get it right where you want to hear it at. Right straight ahead instead of ding-donging back and forth here.
Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock.
For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ochelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ochelli Effect begins now at Ochelli.com, but of course you could be hearing it some other time, some other place, and no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome. Anyway, it's the second hour on a Thursday, and I am grateful to have Larry Hancock with me. Now, lately, I've been calling on Larry to talk a lot about Ukraine. Why? Because he wrote that great book, Creating Chaos, which does spend some of its time on Mr. Putin. I think his analysis has been absolutely priceless, quite honestly. And if you guys don't know about it, go back in my archives, check out the discussions. Even on another radio show, which is no longer in existence because I got fired, I think we did excellent analysis of what was happening as it was happening. But tonight we're going to turn the page, or maybe turn the book. Because Larry wrote something else called Unidentified. He's written several books, many of them on my personal bookshelf. And happily, as a matter of fact, no other author has more books on his shelf than on my shelf than Larry Hancock does. Okay? Just full disclosure there. Fact is, though, Unidentified is a different book, in my opinion. Why? Because it goes to something that is unidentified and yet has also been in the news, you know, amidst the coronavirus and the other things that have gone on the planet and before the Ukrainian invasion and what's going on there. There were these disclosures that were coming out, videos and things. The national security state in America kind of admitting maybe they didn't know about everything that was up in the sky. Maybe they didn't know about everything that was going on because some things remain unidentified. Larry Hancock, how you doing?
I'm doing fine this evening, Chuck. Looking forward to spring.
Well, you know, is it spring? I think it. You know, it's already warm here. I'm not sure how it's going where you are, but we've gotten some more rain and thunderstorms and all that. But not a weather report tonight. I want to go into this book. I want to go into some of the major topics, and we've only got, you know, a short time here tonight to do it. So where do we begin looking at Larry Hancock's approach to UFOs, quite honestly? I mean, that's part of what's in the book, but as per usual, a study on the national security state and its reactions, realities, behaviors, as is a consistent theme throughout your writing. Where do we begin in this book?
Well, I think it's kind of a two-part question, and I would answer that kind of the way the book does. The first question is really, you know, did national security, did the U.S. government, did the Air Force, did the military take this subject seriously? I mean, there's always a lot of debate. There are camps that said, oh, well, no, they've just ignored it. They laughed at it. They didn't pay any attention to it. They must not have had because, you know, they've treated it lightly, whimsically. They don't even have any current, you know, investigations or haven't had any for decades. So they couldn't have treated it seriously. There's another camp that said, oh, yeah, they took it seriously and they know all about it and they're just not telling us. So the first question I address in Unidentified is which way did it go? What do we really know about how the United States government treated the subject? And the good news is that we have thousands and thousands of pages of files now that date back to the 1940s that tell us exactly how they did deal with it. So I'd like to talk about that. But the counter to that question is, well, you know, if they did deal with it seriously, and they did, why don't we have any answers? And that's the second thing I'd like to deal with it, because there are probably some ways to get some answers, but for a variety of reasons, they didn't use those approaches. More scientific approach, a more intelligence-oriented approach. So right. Kind of like two questions. What right. did they do, and why did they fail?
No, fair enough. And also, just really quickly, as my weenie dog decides to bark. You know, I have to be the disruptor, Larry, and not just because I got the dog barking, but because, quite frankly, there are people out there that also believe that this is just simply a program, right, to distract people from real things, that it's just a smoke and mirror show where, you know, Operation Bluebeam, what they're going to do eventually, the ad absurdum of it all boils down to, well, what would happen if an alien invasion was staged? And all of the things that have been laid out here before are just part of a psyop that has gotten overgrown, has gotten out of control in certain ways, but maybe always has been under control. So there is that other sort of murky area that one could examine as well, right? Whether real or imagined or fabricated, it could be useful too to have UFOs out there. And in that way, you know, this is why we're going to have to address, why did they decide to drop this stuff out there? I think before we're done, we're also going to have to mention the UK and their releases, their, you know, letting out their archives about what they had. But the US releasing these videos, which were not new to me, but, you know, headline news, look, we never saw this before. And I'm like, I have. You know, like, very strange, right? These declassified videos, and okay, these are taken by pilots, and what in the hell is actually going on? Someone could say that whether it is a real phenomena, it is aliens itself, it is cover-ups for testing, that it's kind of irrelevant because it's useful as a propaganda tool as well. And could be used to steer society to, you know, the idea, like I said, being floated out there for a while, is that humanity could literally be unified by a collective threat. And if the collective threat were off-world, well, that would all put us on one side of the military equation if there needed to be a military response, right? So what about that idea? Did you go into that in Unidentified?
Yeah, I did because, essentially I did because that brings up, that still stems from that first question. It's sort of like, what did the government really do? I mean, and one of the answers could be, well, has the government used UFOs for security purposes? Real straightforward. I mean, were there, you know, it's a psyop related thing, or is it? And the good news is with the documents, and I think this is the real tiebreaker. And of course, people that don't want to believe this, for some reason, I'm frustrated by people that feel that for some reason anybody created thousands and thousands of pages of documents and somehow backdated them so that they appear to be documents from 1948 or 1949 or 1950. And they're all routine documents, interagency documents, memos, reports, you know, all the day-to-day miscellanea of the way things work. But somebody recreated all of that, and now we have thousands of pages of it. But it doesn't really tell us the story. My tendency is to think, no, that really gives you a look behind the curtains, especially when it tells you things that nobody would admit contemporaneously to those documents. It's sort of like, we know what the Air Force was telling the public. We know what the press releases look like. And now we see the internal documents at the same time, and they tell a totally different story. Well, that gives me a clue to thinking that that's the real story. So to answer your question, what do we see, Chuck? And we see two things. First of all, we see that, for example, the Air Force and the CIA did take these things very seriously. In fact, they were taking them so seriously that by 1948, classified Air Force intelligence documents not only absolutely stated that they were real, that they were physical craft, that they had been tracked, and that they could be profiled for intelligence analysis, so somebody better get with it. The next year, it was being taken so seriously that documents say they assumed that they're Soviet reconnaissance flights, possibly for a pre-strike. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are scared to death. That they activate air defense systems. I won't say scared to death, but they're they're taking it very seriously. Well, very seriously.
You have to accept an unknown as a possibly hostile, you know, whatever. Right? I mean, that's your job if you're in this business. I mean, we don't need to go into the, you know, the dirty underbelly of anything. If we just talk about the regular job here, a flying object in the wrong airspace or an event that is not easily understood because something sort of phenomenal happened, one way or another, it's these people's responsibility to sort that out and find out where did it come from, how did it happen. I mean, just nuts and bolts. I know it sounds really rudimentary, but am I incorrect here?
I mean, that's the real world thing. That's giving us a picture of what really is happening in the day jobs. That's real world. And that picture we see by 1952 is we have a memo from the President of the United States about calling a meeting with Air Force intelligence and various military personnel. The title of the memo is Defense of the Capitol. The president has this meeting. The memos that follow reveal the president was totally dissatisfied with the Air Force's answer to his questions, and he passed the matter on to the CIA, essentially saying, look, this is serious. The Air Force doesn't seem to know how to handle it. What do you guys think? And within 6 months, the CIA director was calling for the matter to be referred to the National Security Council and elevated to the level of a threat to the nation. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that's not what they were saying to the press or in press releases, but I think that illustrates how seriously they did take it for a period of time.
Well, right. So logically, this is something that provoked responses. And meanwhile, it's also not just about things that are up in the sky, as you explain in the book. There were other events, and they seem to coalesce around particular types of facilities during this time period, too, didn't they?
Yeah, what they were, and what led the CIA to the recommendation it made was the fact that there was a very obvious pattern of incidents occurring around atomic warfare sites in the Southwest, Los Alamos, Sandia. The weapons assembly sites in Albuquerque, the weapons stockpile sites in New Mexico and Texas, you know, it was clear that there was a pattern suggesting there was a focus on the core of our atomic weapons complex.
Well, right. So back to your two original questions and the two things that you needed to tackle in the book. You know, I just want to allow you to continue and explain how you went through this process. Obviously, not give everybody everything. But also, there was one particular event I don't want you to forget about that happened at a base where a bunch of things went, well, a little haywire, and they could not sort out exactly how it happened. You have not just an unidentified flying object here, but unidentified causes of certain technological issues to occur. And again, this is not, you know, hackers. This is well pre-internet, ARPANET, anything like that. Something went on here also. Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead.
This has happened a couple of times, and it did not go on all the time. But when it did, and when it went on at a certain level, of course, again, the Air Force would take it very seriously. Now, to establish the time frame, the bottom line was when the Air Force tried to deal with this in the 1950s, they really ended up not coming up with a conclusion. One of the reasons they didn't was that they didn't. They studied incident by incident, hoping to always find the perfect incident that would give an explanation, never finding it. But in the incident you're talking about, kind of a precursor to some of the things we've seen around our carrier groups recently, in the 1970s, there was a set of incidents basically around all of our Strategic Air Command bomber bases and ICBM bases in the northern states, just south of the Canadian border. And these were really the most critical warfighting installations we had. And in one instance, things got to the point, I mean, there were just a series of reports where these UFOs were observed hovering literally over the atomic weapons storage depots on the bases. They were observed hovering over the ICBM silos. And in one instance, things got so bad that several security teams were dispatched. They all reported seeing the UFOs. And when it was all over, it was determined that not only had the perimeter gates to the ICBM complex been breached, that the interior gates to the complex had been breached as well. Now, it's fascinating that we have those reports. I wish we had more, but you can imagine, you know, how, and this was reported to the North American Air Defense Command. It was reported to the Pentagon, and, you know, it was a serious deal because something appeared to be going on that wasn't just, you know, like somebody watching, but actually intruding into the weapon systems. So you can imagine the stir that that would have caused. And that's kind of it. Every once in a while that happens and the things heats up, and in between nothing happens. You mentioned the incidents that have occurred more recently with the photos and that sort of thing.
Right.
Well, the only reason we know about that, or we saw those images or got to see them, is that after the 1970s, basically UFOs were taken off the radar, as it were, not literally, but figuratively, for the U.S. military, and there was not even any reporting system. Certainly nothing other than a local reporting system by a unit or a ship. So there weren't even any systems in play. There were no notices given, no classifications were in place. And one of the things that occurred is in this century, when UFO reports and encounters began coming in to Navy exercises off our coast, there was no place to report them to, and nobody was given any special orders not to talk about them, generally speaking. And, you know, what you saw, because of the situation was so loose, you saw things start to circulate on YouTube and in various chat groups.
Right.
And the interest essentially reignited. But in the interim, we're lucky in a way, because things had gotten so loose that we did see this new information. Now, only a few years later, what we're following is the fact that with legislation in front of Congress forcing the issue, the subject is being taken seriously again, but it's now all the former classification procedures have been re-implemented, so whatever is going on now is being reported, but we're not going to see it.
Well, the funny thing about, you know, a couple of those videos that were released, and they said, look, the Pentagon has absolutely released these images, to me was that I saw some of those images earlier on some lesser-known video platforms where people anonymously uploaded them. And I wasn't, you know, look, I'm confused about the providence of these things. Because, you know, the twisty-turny one where it looks like the UFO is kind of in the sights on a camera on a plane. I saw that, I'm pretty sure, on Live Leak, Daily Motion, years ago.
Well, and we can answer why it happened that way now.
Okay.
That's the good news. The first point is that individual crew member, as you can imagine, something like that, when it happens on a ship, especially a carrier, you know, when you have pilots out there having that encounter, people talk about it. Do you have a picture? You know, send it to me on my phone. Over time, when nobody is ordered, you know, not to talk about it, it leaks out and starts showing up in places. Well, now, at the same time, actually, the matter did get some attention within the Defense Intelligence Agency. The Defense Intelligence Agency set up a small project to look into it, collected some of that same footage, okay, and did some studies of it. And then the fellow who was in charge of that, actually, because he was in position to do it, officially got permission to release some of it. So it showed up officially years after it, some of it had already been leaking on the internet. Mm-hmm. Now, as soon as a little bit got issued officially, that project was closed down. He was out of a job, is now a civilian. And, you know, okay. but that's why it happened in two phases.
Okay. No, fair enough. And meanwhile, as you said, you know, you start with these two very basic questions in the book, and still I've kind of sidetracked you from them because I wanted to tackle what's come out since the book was released, because it's been around a little while and hasn't gotten the attention from the UFO community that I would have expected it to. Considering the very responsible way that you lay out history in any of your books. I would have thought this would have been a great solid thing for them to promote, and they haven't really embraced you. I feel like, Larry. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but let's go through this a little more.
It's my curse, Chuck. I mean, what we've observed in the past is right. that I write about stuff in a pretty restrained matter, very factual. Some would consider it dry, and it just doesn't have the. It has very little sensation, maybe not enough entertainment value, and so it doesn't get the reach within the broad community that right. is looking for, quite frankly, answers. I mean, right. they want to hear. Something that's lively, something that's mysterious, and I try to make things less mysterious. So, like I said, it's my curse. But parts of the UFO community it has had an impact on. Okay. There are a number of people that I'm working with now. There are a couple of organizations that are more scientifically oriented, and those people have responded to it, and it's gotten some traction there. But you're absolutely correct. In the broader UFO community, and certainly with the general public, it hasn't had, you know, it hasn't had the right title. Right. It hasn't had the, quite frankly, if you do a UFO search on Amazon, it's not even going to show up in the top hits because it doesn't have the right words in the title. You know, what can I say? That's life.
No, okay, that's fine. But, I mean, honestly, I would think they should have embraced it due to the fact that it proves that the people with the best technology are military. The people with the highest level of capabilities for surveillance, you know, look, you and I can't necessarily go right up in the air when we see something over our heads. They can do that instantaneously. They can send up drones. They can do all kinds of stuff immediately. Whereas you or I would have to get lucky to be able to even film something like this if we saw it ourselves. So you figure that this is proof positive that people that have the best surveillance techniques and abilities are still baffled by a great many things that they have now witnessed. And that in and of itself ought to be a solid piece of evidence that those that have made these contentions for many years should have been taken more seriously, because these things do exist. They're not just the figments of somebody's imagination. Now, maybe I'm behind the times on this, but I mean, honestly, that's what I take your book to be, is this is proof that there is no way that you can explain everything you see in the sky. Okay.
And I think that it does. It offers that proof. I think here's what the problem is. I mean, fundamentally, in the book, I discuss incidents where UFOs were observed on radar. They were triangulated with visual instruments. Then the net result with that is that there was absolutely no doubt that they were anomalous in terms of the acceleration that they have, the G loading that they can endure, even the material's strength. That's required of any material that we're aware of. That all comes from the period of the late 1940s and early 1950s. We absolutely knew then, and the reports themselves say that. there's just no doubt that A, these are real, and B, they're not earthly technology. They really, you know, they're something else.
Well, and a fascinating point is that over the past 75 years, even though our technology has evolved, it seems as though theirs has remained consistent, hasn't it? Whatever these things
that's
are.
Correct. Because when we have these newest observations from aircraft with better sensor suites, infrared, you know, video cameras, that sort of thing, we see exactly the same thing. We see exactly the same UFO capabilities, the same acceleration, the same materials loading. So they haven't, in capability and performance, what they have, they display now is the same thing they were displaying around 1950. So clearly, it's the same anomalous technology, and clearly it's not, in some instances, it's clearly not Chinese drones or Russian drones or any, you know, there's just no doubt about that. The problem for the military, just as much now as it was then, is twofold. And to really, you know, lay out that problem, the military is charged with responding to threats. Right now, they've got a lot of threats on their plate. Okay,
sure.
And that's been true for a long time. So when you look at the resources that are assigned within the military, if something is not classified as a threat, if there's no sign that it's, you know, carried out offensive actions, created damage, whatever, interest fades in it pretty quickly because they got a lot of other things to do. When the Air Force dropped the whole UFO program at the end of the 60s, when they wrote their summary report, they left on their books hundreds of totally unidentified reports. There was they admitted they couldn't identify them. But their summary of the report was, during all this time, in all our studies, we have found no indication that these things are a threat. And
well,
therefore,
yeah, do me a favor.
We don't actually spend any time on them.
Right. Now, pause for a second and mute up just to give your Skype a break because I hear it starting to crack up a little. And let it recompress itself while I make a point here and see if you can follow along because I want to put something in context for you and the listener, obviously. I don't need to tell you this, but I want to just see if you agree. Point is that it doesn't matter what the threat is. Now, somebody might be saying, well, of course, military threats, and we're looking at technology, and do the Russians have it? Okay, put all that aside, even your considerations, because the military might study the migration patterns of birds in order to figure out if they can do damage to aircraft, okay? Literally, or in some cases, we've seen military studies on environmental conditions in order to figure out if it has an effect on their equipment, where their bases are, do they need new things to combat, you know, is there higher sea levels, all that. So they have to assess threats that come from anyone and anything, from within, from without, from nature, from enemies, from allies. They're supposed to cover all the angles, and obviously they're going to dedicate resources to things that do present a threat. Now, if they study the migration pattern of, I don't know, a Canadian goose, okay, it may be fully irrelevant. By the time they're done studying, it doesn't matter. There's only so many. They're not near our bases, whatever. They come up with a conclusion. That's the end of it. They're not going to look at the Canadian goose anymore. Or they're not going to look at the air pollution in a particular area because it has no effect on jet engines, let's say. But they might study it, and then they drop it. But only when they've determined, generally speaking, if they're doing their jobs right. And I'm not saying they're always, you know, absolutely correct. But a lot of people get paid to do exactly this. Figure out if there is a threat or a problem with anything. Okay? So it could be a matter of a natural thing. It could be, again, are the Soviets developing technologies? Are the Chinese developing technologies? Back post-World War II, do we have loose German technology that got out and went to somewhere else? Do we have other emergent nations that might have actually discovered new stuff that we don't know about just yet? And they have to have gone through all of that. And finally, they conclude that even if they can't identify what the hell went on, or they found an anomalous incident where maybe a Canadian goose did take down, you know, a fighter, they might determine that the threat is not worthy of taking action or of doing anything about. And again, it could be a natural thing. It could be the air quality. It doesn't matter. They say, okay, it's a minimal problem. Put it aside. In the case of the UFOs, and in the case of these incidents, because there was no immediate threat, the weapons weren't launched, capabilities weren't completely crippled, there wasn't a serious exposure, they kind of have to put it aside eventually and say, well, even though we don't know exactly what's happening, we do know that it's not something that is impeding military action and preparedness and so on and so forth. At least not enough that we need to have a program about it. So therefore, they stop investigating. Is that accurate, Larry?
That's absolutely accurate. And we can give two things to support it, or two examples to support it. One of the reasons they were intensely concerned with the UFOs in the period of the 40s, the 50s, into the 60s, was that as far as the defense of the continent, defense of America, it was air defense. Lots of interceptors, lots of radar stations. You know, we thought we were going to be attacked by air. And so therefore, you know, this is unidentified flying objects are a big deal when you're, you know, dealing with bombers, potentially bomber attack. But by the end of the 60s, that was gone. And quite frankly, through the late 70s, the 80s, by the 90s, there was no more American air defense. That's why in 2001, there were only like 8 alert fighters in the entire United States, and the entire radar system had been disassembled, and all you had was FAA radars, and if you turn your transponders off, the plane was invisible. It was just a change in the overall threats. And threats were from missiles, not aircraft. Okay, so to some extent that changes the context where as you're just saying, where UFOs, you know, had been an object, you know, we had interceptors being scrambled and engaging them, and so it was a real concern, and then it wasn't. But the other part of that example is the reason it's a real concern now is only because the reason the Navy brought this up, and the reason is simply because suddenly we had enough of these incidents occurring in restricted airspace out over the ocean, not over the continental U.S., out over the ocean where these carrier groups were exercising across off San Diego and off Florida, that these UFOs were actually viewed as an aircraft hazard. They were appearing. You know, sometimes they were tracked, sometimes they were not. Pilots started seeing them, and the concern really was that they were an air danger to these military exercises, to the aircraft flying off the carriers. And that's the only reason it came up in the first place. The only reason the photos that we're referring to as part of the Nimitz incident off San Diego, the only reason that interceptors were even sent out was that a radar operator became so concerned there were high-speed unknown objects flying through the exercise area that he got permission to dispatch interceptors to look at them. It was a safety concern, not a threat, and that's what resurfaced this whole thing. But it didn't resurface over the national security of continental United States, it resurfaced as an air safety issue for those carrier exercises.
So when I was talking about the geese and everything, I really should say that it could be a hazard that they also have to study, as opposed to a direct threat, which would indicate that there was some intellectual, you know, something behind it that is causing a direct threat. Something could just be a hazard, too. And this would be another thing that they would have to work with. I mean, you have to adjust for hazards, or you have to know how to deal with them. And therefore, again, whether it's a goose or a UFO, right? you got to know how this works and how to avoid them and how to not have the problems with them. This is also part of the job, not just threat assessment, but sort of hazard assessment, for lack of a better term, then.
It is, and that gets back. Most people really don't understand. You brought up the point, you know. So if UFOs are reported over, you know, a military base or this or that, you know, it's not like the entire United States military stopped paying attention to things that showed up that were identified and, you know, could potentially be a threat. It's not anybody stopped doing that. It began to be reported locally, you know, by a ship or by a base. And it was this, what's called a PSYOP, a situations report, or, you know, basically a local, let's tell our commander that there's something here. It's a concern. Maybe the commander will bounce it up the chain one level, maybe won't. If it's really serious, maybe it'll get reported to NORAD, maybe it won't. But there was no general program in play. It was just routine military reporting of situations and threats and whatever. That's the way it was through the 80s and the 90s, and to some extent probably is still now. There wasn't anything like the Air Force Blueprint Project that consolidated all the reports. And there certainly, as what the Air Force had never done, when the Air Force and the CIA had recommended it back in 1952 to go up the food chain in the intelligence community to long-term analysis, where there are task groups that look for patterns and you know, motives and really forward thinking, and it never got there. And it still hasn't got there. And that's part of the problem, was that it was never addressed as anything other than incident by incident. Is it a threat? No, it's not. Is it unidentified? Yes, it is. Can we solve it? If we can, we write it in the log, and if we can't, we write it in the log, and we go on until the next. Nobody looked at it as a body of activity. And I think that's one of the real problems from a scientific standpoint, is that it never got treated in terms of pattern analysis. It never got treated in terms of intentions. It was never elevated to that level of study. It was just a one-off thing, incident by incident by incident.
So I have a live question, and I'm going to consolidate it here because it has to do with the continental U.S. and sightings, say, in Arizona, Nevada, parts of California, where indeed we do have special weapons facilities. And the question boils down to this. Let's see, how can I put this? Yes. Is this, did you happen to study in the book whether this was still a very useful thing, whether identified or unidentified, when people cited these things to sort of cover up for emergent technologies like the stealth fighter they say here? I think often of that one airplane that we saw during the Falklands incident that lifted up straight up in the air, you know, did that instead of using a runway. When people first saw these things kind of happening, was it not something that was useful, just the phenomena itself, to sort of cover up some of those technologies that, you know, occasionally people might have spotted in the air that were being tested in the continental U.S.?
The answer to that is absolutely. And yes, I do go into that at considerable length in the book. And the good news is, to a large extent, we know enough about when that happened so that we can kind of develop a picture of it. For example, when the U.S. was, so I'll give you a few examples just to make that real. When the U.S. was first really concerned about when and if the Soviets would develop an atomic bomb, they came up with a project to launch stratospheric constant level balloons, really big balloon trains that go up in the air, stay at the same altitude, and they put like acoustic detectors on them, because they had a theory that they could actually hear something like an atomic bomb blast at certain levels in the atmosphere all the way from here to Russia. They didn't want the Russians to know that they were doing that, so actually they started encouraging reports of these very high altitude, you know, white dots in the air as being UFO reports. And we actually have documents to say the CIA was encouraging the Air Force to make sure those reports were publicized so maybe we could even fool the Soviets. Like if they see this big white dot, it was not our balloon, it was a UFO. So like encourage UFO reports of these high altitude bright lights that move slowly. So yeah, that's an example. The CIA did the same thing with the U-2, Stratus, high altitude, very high altitude aircraft, the SR-71. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, at one point, the CIA itself went so far as to have its scientists issue a statement that like 70% plus of all UFO reports came from the U-2 or the SR-71 misidentification. You know, that was definitely not true. We know that's not true. But so the point was there have been absolutely there are cases where they wanted to encourage UFO sightings to cover up new developments. But there's also a much nastier side to that. And I think I've mentioned it to you, Chuck. There are a couple of books that I refer to people in the 1970s, during the Reagan-era Star Wars program, we were developing a lot of new technologies for example, imaging satellites and doing other things with lasers, very, very groundbreaking stuff. And this was being conducted off of the Kirtland test range outside of Albuquerque. Well, a scientist, an engineer in Albuquerque who lived up in a position to kind of observe what was going on at Kirtland, started seeing strange things, interpreting them as UFOs, and actually went to the Air Force with his evidence, his videos, his recordings, everything. The Air Force launched a counterintelligence effort against him because he was also taking this to UFO groups. And the Air Force was very concerned that, you know, your adversary loves open intelligence. You know,
right.
They're going to go, oh, what's going on at Kirtland? We know Kirtland is a big research base. They're seeing UFOs at Kirtland. Let's go look. So they actually launched a psychological warfare campaign against this individual, against people that he was working with, against the UFO group that he was working with. And they managed to persuade a very prominent UFO investigator to support it, to feed bad information, bad videos, bad recordings back to him and the UFO community, right, as part of a combined counterintelligence psychological warfare program. That's as nasty as it gets. So we do have an example of that as well. In the end, unfortunately, the man literally was driven insane and committed suicide. So, right, to answer the question that got sent to you, absolutely those things can happen, and we even know about some of them.
Some of them, but there may indeed be more that are still as yet unclassified.
Yep.
And I always put that provision on these things because as much as we are able to see a great deal of what went on, I always assume there are still hidden, you know, aspects to all this. And I haven't been proven wrong yet, okay, because always more will come later, you know what I'm saying? So makes perfect sense to me. With the last 10 minutes or so, I know I've asked you a lot of questions and kind of taken you off track a little bit. What else would you like people to take away from this very interesting book? Again, Unidentified. I'll give you guys the link to go find the book and purchase it in the show notes and all that. Again, my apologies to Larry Hancock because we kind of did this discussion somewhere else. But we get it recorded and done here. And it's not the first time I've discussed this with you, Larry, but it's always intriguing to me to look at the realities. And, you know, you might think of it as dry, or some other people might think of it as dry, when you're taking a look at, well, you know, how does this work? And let's get into the realities, because it's always lost in these, you know, TV shows and presentations about this. Like, they go, oh, well, the national security apparatus should have done this. And it's like ludicrous statements most of the time, because none of these people ever bothered to take a look at what actually happens, you know, when something occurs that could be, well, in this genre of events. Okay. So I really appreciate it, and appreciate you taking the time. But like I said, I'll give you the last, well, let's call it 9 minutes now, to go into this and tell people what else they should take away, and also want to go get your book for.
Yeah, I think one of the thing that jumps out at me, and I sort of mentioned this, is there are areas of the intelligence community that exist to study long-term problems. They exist to monitor long-term threats and determine when a threat goes from just being, you know, potential to actually generating a warning. And none of those ever, you have to have a procedure and a protocol and a methodology that allows you simply to make estimates, because you won't know if a threat becomes real until it actually happens. But during the Cold War, some very good techniques were developed for doing this, and it required collecting a lot of data, looking for patterns, looking for anomalies in the data. You know, when does something change that maybe indicates there's something going on here? And what I found, and what we just discussed, is that because UFOs as a subject never got designated by the National Security Council, never got tasked as a national security threat, because they never got referred to any of these intelligence groups for long-term study, these techniques were never used on UFOs. Okay? But they have been very effective in other, you know, in other contexts, with things that you have to look at over a long period of time. You can't just look at them incident by incident. So I introduced this concept in the book, Unidentified, and actually devote several chapters to saying, oh, here's how they could have used it. Let's take these techniques, let's go back and look at what happened, and let's set up a scenario and say, okay, maybe what was going on was this, let's test it. And I show how that would work in the book, and actually lay it out piece by piece as to how it's carried out and how you make those judgments. Well, there's no reason that same technique, which is a very formal process, a very structured process, requires a lot of slogging just to create the baselines. There's no reason you can't make it something of a scientific approach to the subject. And at the moment, there is an organization, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, that is pursuing a number of scientific studies of the UAP phenomena, UFO, UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. I'm part of that group, and actually am part of a team that's doing research on intentions analysis as relates to UFOs, looking at a lot of scenarios, doing a lot of pattern analysis, a lot of database work. And I guess that's what I'd like to offer, is it's the thing that the Air Force never did. It's the thing that the National Intelligence Community never did. As far as we can tell, it's not being done now, because as we just discussed, UAP reports, UFO reports, are still being considered on a one-off basis. Somebody gets the report, they look at it, they do everything in the world they can to identify it, and then they file it. And then we move on to the next one. Maybe there's a group that's doing pattern analysis that we don't know about. Could be, but certainly there hasn't been in the past. And so what I what I like to put on the table is there are approaches to this subject that you know, not only can you do scientific analysis of the physical characteristics of the thing, you can say what they are and what they aren't in terms of what can do this acceleration and G loading. You can certainly say that they're not conventional. You can explore their potential types of propulsion, but you can also, you know, explore something more interesting to me is what are they doing here? Can we develop some intentions? Can we develop any motives? What have they been engaged in? Not just speculating off two or three incidents. Some of, you know, might have been a hoax, might not have been a hoax, but really by applying methodology to the problem. And so I introduced that in the book, still engaged in trying to do that. Actually, 2 years into an intentions project with people from this SCU group. And if folks want to know kind of what the group is about and what we're doing, I sent you a link. We have a conference coming up in June that can be attended either virtually or in person. It's in Birmingham, outside the Space Center there, as a matter of fact. And we'll be reviewing our projects there. But I just like to get across the thing that we do have some tools to go beyond the, wow, gee whiz, look at that, that's really strange approach that has generally, I wonder what that was, been taken over the past decades.
Right. Well, no, and I definitely want to pay attention to what it is you guys come up with. I mean, because pattern recognition is required here. If we're to discover any sort of evidence of intentionality, because at the end of the day, what is the ultimate question here? Not just from the military's perspective, but I think it should be from all our perspectives. What is the intention? Is there, you know, I mean, look, a lot of allegations have been made that contact has already been made and we're not allowed to know about it. And look, I in the past, I would have just scoffed directly at that. But I don't know. I absolutely do not know for certain what to make of this, because, again, it seems illogical to assume that all of it is of an earthly origin, and therefore we must figure out what is going on here. Are we just being observed? You know, is somebody just driving through the safari and we're in a zoo, right? I think I brought that up to somebody not too long ago. You know, and I said, maybe we're just a giant zoo and these guys are driving through the safari, you know, to take a look at the animals.
I prefer the concept that we're an intergalactic reality show of some sort. You know, like, okay, this season we're covering. But I will say, just to kind of wrap that thing up, it is clear that there are patterns. There are anomalous patterns of activity. We should be able to do some of them. And they change over time. I think the one thing I will say that is very evident is it's not just one thing. It's there are things in play where the patterns change over time, and you know it's not simple. It's I don't think it's just the zoo thing. I don't think you have to take a deeper look at it than that, and that's kind of what we're doing. But it's not just one thing.
No, and you know what? That would make the most sense anyway. Although I got to tell you, South Park, the cartoon TV show, already beat you to the intergalactic reality show concept. it was one of those funny episodes. Anyway, I'm a cartoon guy, Larry. My apologies. But it's all very interesting. And I think eventually something should be responsibly established here so that we can understand what's happening. You know, it's difficult to figure out what's going on here on the ground. It would be nice to know what's going on over our heads. It would be nice to know what's going on everywhere. But the search will continue. So I'm going to give you guys the link to that that conference that Larry talked about and some other stuff in the show notes. But Larry Hancock, thanks again for having this discussion with me.
It's good to be back, Chuck.
And hopefully you'll be back again in 2 weeks, and who knows what we'll be talking about by then. So Yikes. You never know. But Larry Hancock, an excellent resource. Larry-Hancock.com. You can still go there, follow his blog and all that. And I urge you to pick up any of his books. Not a one of them is bad. Okay? It's just that simple. They're all informative. They're all great. Anyway, I hope you guys are all great. I am Emilio Celli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.